In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Peter Hart and I've been joined in my gaff by lovely Gary Bain. Hello, Gary.
Hi, Pete. How are you today?
I'm very well. Very, 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 very well. And what are we doing today, Gary?
Well, today, Pete, it's the last in our series, Air War Over the Somme. And this one, unsurprisingly, is called Endgame on the Somme.
I often call things Endgame. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you are game.
Yeah. You're approaching your end.
Well, it's better than approaching your end. Anyway, whatever the tactical gains and theoretical professional.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
Whatever the tactical gains and theoretical advances made in the September attacks, one thing remained clear.
What was it, Gary?
The British were as far from a strategic breakthrough as ever.
Yeah. The Fourth Army had carried the original German third line after 3 months of battering and buggering their way forward. But they now face yet another trench system built by the Germans along the ridge stretching from Le Translois to Tilloy. I'm not sure how you pronounce either of them, but there you go.
Two more trench systems were under construction, stretching back towards Bapaume.
Bapaume.
Bapaume, Bapaume, and beyond.
Ooh.
The Reserve Army on top of Thiepval Ridge.
Is that Fifth Army? I never know when it changes its title. Yeah.
Still faced multiple German trench lines, bolstered by the all-too-familiar fortified woods and villages.
Yes, but somebody is still optimistic. Who is that masked man, Gary?
Well, Haig was still convinced that the German army was ready to collapse. Intelligence reports had indicated problems of morale amongst the hard-pressed German infantry, and Haig was determined to carry on the offensive. The decision having been taken, Rawlinson's Fourth Army continued to batter itself, or as you said, bugger itself senseless, against the German lines.
Right, now, it's at this moment, just as German resistance, German morale's teetering a bit, something happens. Why do the Germans have a belt buckle with a certain inscription on? And what is that inscription, Gary?
Gott mit uns.
And what does that mean?
God's with us. And indeed he was, because the weather broke.
Oh.
The autumn weather deteriorated from mellow fruitfulness.
Oh, lovely.
To cold rain. And soon the battlefield had turned into a morass of mud. A
morass of mud. You've swallowed that dictionary again.
Yes.
Do you mean it was a bit muddy, Gary?
It was very muddy. Now, in the air, it's not muddy in the air. In the air, the Royal Flying Corps lost one of their best pilots on the return of Captain Albert Ball to England. I wanted to say Alan Ball then, and that's your fault.
Yeah. Towards the end of September, Ball had become... he was beginning to be stressed, I think it's fair to say. It's not that he's becoming cowardly, far from it, but he's aware of the risks he's taken. The risks he'd taken, they range from rash to suicidal, really. He carries on fighting, but some of the sights he saw in the air seem to have affected him deeply. And you've got a quote here that sort of sums that up.
And this is Captain Albert Ball of 60 Squadron. She was a two-seater and I fired 5 rounds into her. She burst into flames and fell upside down. Although she dropped like a stone, I saw her observer climb out of his seat and jump clear of the flames. He must have preferred that kind of death to the chance of being roasted.
Tortured a bit by... It's a murderous trade they're in. They're fighting for their country. It's fair enough and all that, but it is horrible. And his nerves seem to get tighter. He's getting tired, exhausted. He flies multiple missions a day. How would you describe this in modern terminology, Gary?
Well, not surprisingly, he's suffering from combat fatigue.
What does he do this time?
Well, he therefore asked his squadron leader, Major Smith Barry, if he could go home. Now, this is the second time he'd asked, and last time he got transferred as a result. But this time, his request was treated with due respect and swiftly approved by higher command.
He'd scored something... By the standards of the time, and that includes airplanes are just set, forced down, not necessarily shot down, he'd got some 31 victories. Is he the real thing?
Yeah, there's no doubt whatsoever. Whatever the total that Albert Ball brought down, he was very much the genuine article. He was the first high-scoring British ace. Bearing in mind you only needed 5 victories to be considered an ace.
Now... on the ground, because all of this we're rabbiting on about in the air is actually entirely dominated by what's going on the ground. the bad weather means that the next land attacks are postponed. Observation is difficult both on the ground and in the air. And why does mud interfere with artillery?
Well, because you've got to bring up the shells and it's almost impossible to move the guns. And as they sank in the mud, their accuracy declined radically.
Now, there are brief breaks in the weather, and Hagen Rawlinson order repeated attacks. And can you just run through those attacks? Probably attaching the name of the actions and battles?
No. No, of course not, but I'll tell you the dates. The 7th, the 12th, the 18th, 23rd, 28th and 29th of October.
Any successes?
No, all failed abjectly and barely any gains were made. The infantry had to force their way through the mud in addition to all the other manifold dangers and difficulties of going over the top. It was pretty dangerous in the air as well, as Lieutenant Eric Rouse of 34 Squadron relates.
The barrage started and crept forward. The men were rather slow in starting and so losing the advantage of the barrage. They only advanced 100 yards, after which they sat down in shell holes, while the barrage still crept back, leaving the Boche in perfect comfort. That's a creeping barrage, is properly developed then. Anyway, he goes on to say, we went to drop a message about this and then returned going down the line again, being greeted by machine gun fire this time. Saw reinforcements going over, who also stopped in the shell holes. Gordon Kidd and Phillips were flying a Marine parasol. I happened to be watching them at the moment a shell appeared to strike the wing amidships, which immediately folded up, the machine going into a spinning nosedive, and continued in this manner until the ground was reached. It was a horrid sight. They must have been killed instantaneously. The barrage during this attack is the worst I've ever flown in. Flying in the thick of it at 1,000 feet was terrifying. Both beyond ourselves when we got back. Just past,
you know, beside themselves.
Beside themselves, yeah.
Now, with the infantry hamstrung by the mud and with the artillery not operating at full efficiency, the British were effectively back to square one. But this was not the only reason for failure.
Oh, yeah. The Germans... They're not finished. They bring up fresh divisions. They reinforce their artillery because remember that Verdun's dying down. They adjust their tactics on the ground to protect their machine gunners from the creeping barrage. They move them further back, in other words. What worked in September doesn't work in October when the weather's changed. This is the roller coaster of... As one side does one thing, the other side react. It's not a simple learning curve. It's complex.
And the weather had, in effect, neutralised the British artillery.
Yeah, of course. In the air, they just can't. They often can't fly at all. It's just too bloody wet and windy. A bit like yourself, Gary. And this is what Lieutenant Leslie Horridge, moving on, 7th Squadron says, RFC. We have quite a lot of nice wet days. Now, notice the perspective of a hard-working pilot. We have quite a lot of nice wet days lately, although it has usually cleared up a bit in the afternoon. It has been very windy too. I found I could make the machine go backwards if I wanted to. On one shoot, I was doing it It took me more than half an hour to get from the target to the ground station near the battery. It would have taken 3 minutes as a rule. It just means the wind is blowing. And I've seen, you know, these early aircraft, if they're only going at 60 miles an hour and the wind's blowing against them, they're almost static or going backwards.
Now, when there were gaps in the weather, the Royal Flying Corps continued its work undaunted, day and night. But the problems were mounting.
What are these problems? Let's sum them up. Let's just sum them up.
Well, it was becoming clear that even the best available RFC Scout, the Newport 17, was demonstrably slower and could also be outclimbed by the Albatross D1 and D2 Scouts. Now, that is a serious situation.
It's not even a British Scout. It's French.
Yeah.
The German aircraft, they're also hampered by the weather, but they've got a newfound sense of purpose. They formed the German Air Force formally on the 8th of October, and the German aviators, they're cheering up, aren't they? The new Scouts, the Albatross, the other new Scouts arriving, and the inspirational successes of Oswald Bolker, commanding Chester 2. They are, the other side's morale's improving.
Now, as you mentioned, the Verdun operations are at last diminishing in scale. The German aircraft there were redeployed to the Somme, and soon they had some 333 aircraft at their disposal.
So how does that compare with the RFC figures then, Gary? You're best at statistical analysis.
Well, the Royal Flying Corps had lost both their qualitative and numerical advantage, for they deployed in total just 328 aircraft, a rough equality of numbers, which was unnecessary because you can work out that 333 and 328 are roughly
aircraft?
The same.
How many more aircraft?
Five.
No need for maths with Pete and Gary. That was just straight out.
Yeah. Now, the British reinforcements that arrived offered nothing new, and some of the replacement aircraft were obviously useless. Thus, the ill-fated BE-12 Scout was completely...
Let's not talk about that, because that is the most useless aircraft.
Well, and it was completely withdrawn from the fray after only the briefest exposure to the grim reality of the aerial combat zone.
You got in trouble after a brief exposure, didn't you?
Yes, but still the fighting went on.
Oh! Now, on 22nd of October, let's look at some fighting. 22nd of October, while escorting a photographic reconnaissance aircraft over Bapaume, Lieutenant F.L. Bernard, now that's Franklin Bernard, you looked him up, didn't you?
Yeah, Franklin Leslie Bernard.
Oh,
but I couldn't find his observer, unfortunately.
His observer was F.S. Rankin, I'm not sure. Let's pretend his name's Frank Sicily.
Right.
They become involved in a series of desperate running fights. And can you imagine that they're in an FE-2B and what it was like standing up in that exposed front cockpit? It's just awful. They're so exposed that they, and when they stand on the struts to fire back over the thing, it's incredible. And what does Franklin Bernard, Lieutenant Franklin Bernard of 18 Squadron, say about this?
We found three more HA on our tail.
HA, Gary?
Hostile aircraft. The observer put one drum into one, which was passing straight over our heads at very close range, and this machine immediately became out of control, the tail and back of the fuselage being on fire. It went down in a spin. The remaining two HA were now firing from behind, and the observer stood up to get a shot at them. One more HA was seen to go down in a nosedive with smoke from its engine. The observer was still firing when he was hit in the head and fell sideways over the side of the Natel. I managed to catch his coat as he was falling and by getting on the front seat pulled him back. I then got back in the pilot's seat. The engine and most of the controls had been shot, but I managed to get the machine over our lines and landed 200 yards behind our front line. Bear in mind, he's doing this whilst flying an aircraft.
And being attacked.
Yes.
And can you imagine the weight? For instance, if I was the pilot and you suddenly fell over...
I'd take you with me.
You'd take me with... But any size man, you know, falling, and he just grabs his coat and somehow drags him back in. I think that's an amazing story. Does it have an impact on the chap? Well, it does. Funnily enough, we've got a different perspective of this because we've got the commanding officer of 18 Squadron took a really sympathetic attitude. And he says this is Major George Carmichael. He says, Lieutenant F.L. Bernard was in combat when his observer, Lieutenant F.S. Rankin, who was standing up to fire back over the top plane, was hit and would have fallen out had not Bernard, seized his coat and dragged him into the cockpit. He actually held him there until, with almost superhuman strength and skill, he brought his machine to our landing area. The observer, Rankin, unfortunately did not survive. Remember, he was hit in the head. Lieutenant Barnard was so affected by his experience that I had to arrange for his posting home, and his nerves were so badly affected that I do not think he was able to return to the Western Front. And I do not blame him at all. Can you imagine that, Gary?
No, I mean, I can't.
It's beyond anything we can conceive of.
Yet for all their problems and casualties, the Royal Flying Corps stuck to their task and continued to perform the various roles for which the infantry were dependent upon them. When the weather closed in again, it was rather a mixed blessing. Every day without their eyes in the sky was a disaster for the British attacks against the Trans-Loy Ridge.
Yeah, on the other hand, as was implied in a couple of quotes, Horridge's quote earlier, it does give a bit of a break to the hard-pressed pilots. And, they wouldn't be human if they weren't relieved sometimes when they couldn't fly. Now, Trenchard, what does he do? Because he's running out of resources, if you like to treat pilots and machines as resources. What does he do?
Well, in desperation, he requested assistance from the Royal Naval Air Service. And to the eternal credit of the RNAS, their response was immediate. They formed 8 Squadron RNAS flying a mixture of Sopwith Pups, Newports and Sopwith 1.5 Strutters, which moved down to Vert Gallant Airfield, where they were attached to the 5th Brigade RFC. Now, I had a look at where Vert Gallant Airfield was because I didn't know. And it's near a place called Le Rosselle, which is at a junction of the D31 and N25 roads, which is the Amiens to Doulon Road, which is completely superfluous, but I just wanted to know where it was.
I went there once with a trip, and it's interesting to be there. It's such a famous airfield. I didn't know where it was.
It's just a field at the side of that road, isn't it?
As far as I remember. I forget a lot.
Now, despite this appearance of harmony, inter-service rivalry and jealousies had not been entirely dissipated, as Trenchard and Baring found when they paid an inspection visit next day. And this is Captain Maurice Baring of Headquarters Royal Flying Corps. We went to the naval squadron, which is now attached to us, and which is on the same aerodrome as number 32. They said they would like the oil used by number 32 for machine guns. It was better than their own naval oil. We then went on to number 32. They asked if they might have the naval oil, which they said was better than their own military oil. When the matter was investigated later, there was found to be not the slightest difference between the naval and the military oil.
And that sums up life in the forces at times, doesn't it? It's always bad. The other man's grass is always greener. Naval 8, they'd settle in for a week and then they enter the fray in early November. And they are useful, aren't they? We're not going to dwell on it a lot, but they are a useful addition. Just even a squadron makes a difference because the RFC's running out of people, you know.
But even in the midst of the late October clouds, there's one silver lining for the hard-pressed British.
What's that?
On the 28th of October, Oswald Bulker was involved in a mid-air collision. After the impact, both pilots fell earthwards, but Bulker was killed. Jaster 2 was stunned by the news. Bulker had been their mentor, a stern taskmaster, but a true hero figure to his men.
He reminds me of Matt McLaughlin.
Yes.
Stern taskmaster.
And late.
But a hero. He's not dead, Gary.
Now, with one less fearsome enemy to worry about, the work of the Royal Flying Corps went on as before.
Endless photographic missions, reconnaissance missions, relentless, never-ending artillery observation duties. It never stops, does it? It never stops. Whenever, that is, the weather allows them to go. If the weather's fine, they're up. They're up and about. And this is a quote from you this time. And this is Flight Sergeant Alfred Shepherd, known to his mates as Alfie, I bet, of 5 Squadron RFC.
Got up at 5 to do my first shoot with Sergeant Lawford. That's Sergeant Bill Lawford.
You've been looking things up again.
I had to range a battery of 9.2-inch howitzers, the call letter being K. The clouds were very big and a strong wind was blowing, 50 mile per hour. We started at 7 a.m. and got to 1,000 feet, and I had just finished ringing up the aerodrome when the engine cut out and we had to make a forced landing and just got into the aerodrome. We were at one time, just before we landed, travelling at 100 mile per hour, about 50 foot up, and goodness knows how we came down safely. This was one of the nearest goes I've ever had to having a complete smash-up.
Now, Some of them have been in action for the best part of 6 months. Because remember, the Battle of the Somme does not start in July. We talked about this. The aerial offensive starts months before.
But for the most part, they bore their trials and tribulations with courage and fortitude. And you're going to relate what Lieutenant Leslie Horridge of 7 Squadron says.
The old Hun has been rather more active lately, but I expect he will be squashed again before long. He breaks out periodically, especially if the Kaiser has been stirring him up, but he's usually put in his proper place before long. And if you like, that sums up the morale, good morale. I mean, they're tired, but they're carrying on.
Yeah, the baton of the offensive was finally passed from the exhausted 4th Army to the Reserve Army, which was now renamed 5th Army.
Is that when it happened?
Which was getting ready to launch an attack on Beaumont Hamel. Now, at this point, we'll take a short break while you look for a pen.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
By November, the state of the war in the air over the Somme was clearly defined.
In what way, Gary?
Well, the arrival of German reinforcements, the reorganisation and refocusing of the German Air Force, the fighting legacy of Boelcke bequeathed to the young pilots of Jaster 2, but most of all, of the technological pendulum. They had all combined to leave the Royal Flying Corps in a position of marked inferiority.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, take the DH2. Let's take the DH2. It had been an important part of gaining the dominance over the Somme back in June, July. But is the pusher, the single-seater pusher aircraft like the DH2, is it really the answer? Is it to things?
Well, no. By this time, more powerful and faster tractor aircraft were dominating the skies. And I'm going to tell you what Second Lieutenant Gwilym Lewis of 32 Squadron says. I know I felt very uncomfortable with 2 HA well above me, and in spite of the fact that I climbed to about 13,500, they were still above, which is very demoralising. We shall have to bring out some very fine machines next year if we are to keep up with them. Their scouts are very much better than ours now on average. The good old days of July and August when 2 or 3 DH2s used to push half a dozen Huns onto the chimney tops of Bapaume are no more. In the Roland, they possessed the finest two-seater machine in the world, and now they have introduced a few of their single-seater ideas, and very good they are too. One specimen especially deserves mention. They are manned by jolly good pilots, probably the best, and the juggling they can do when they are scrapping is quite remarkable. They can fly around and round a DH2 and made one look quite silly.
Now, one obvious solution, and by this time in the war, they're moving on to it, is if you can't get them in the air, the Albatross, which is the aircraft he's referring to in particular, they did have other scouts. Other scouts are also available. But the big answer is to get them on the ground. Get the bastards while they're on the ground. So the idea of what? What? Bomb them? Bomb airfields?
Yeah, because they're helpless on the ground.
Yeah.
And you're going to relate what Captain Joseph Callahan of 18 Squadron says about that.
Could see conspicuous lights on the ground in a northerly direction. So I went to see what they were. They were at Villers Le Cagnicourt. We had a good look at the place and we could see hangars on the western side of the flares. At 9:15 p.m. from 5,000 feet, dropped three Hales 20-pound high-explosive bombs. The first two burst about 200 yards south of the hangars, and the other two were about 100 yards south of the hangars as well. Why doesn't he write English? All lights are immediately put out, and as we hovered over the aerodrome to drop our remaining bombs, a machine was wheeled out of a hangar and took off into the wind. We followed him by keeping our nose down, kept him in sight. We were getting quite close to him. We were at 4,000 feet, and he was at about 1,500 feet, when he turned sharply and we turned to get on top of him. He was drawing away from us, so I opened fire on him and gave him a drum. He then went out of sight and we followed in his direction. As we came over the aerodrome again, we dropped our remaining three bombs. Two burst on the aerodrome and the third one hit a hangar. No fire was caused. We hovered around but could not see the hostile machine. Now, you'll notice from his own description, these bombs and they're only 20-pound bombs. Are they causing devastation on the ground?
No. And despite these bombing raids, the flow of casualties couldn't be staunched. On the 13th of November, the Battle of the Ancre was launched as the last gasp of the Somme offensive. General Sir Hubert Gough's relatively fresh 5th Army lunged forward into the valley of the River Ancre to the north of the Somme.
Yeah, they were assisted by a reasonably effective artillery bombardment. Things are getting better. The infantry make considerable initial progress. It's quite good. It's quite an impressive battle, this. Beaumont Hamel falls at last, meant to fall on the first day, but it falls there. Beaucourt was captured, and the positions along the Thiepval Ridge are developed further, to, you know. What about the attacks on the Serre and Redan ridges further north, where, of course, the famous Powell's attack had been on the Serre? How are they doing?
They'd failed.
Oh. I left the failure bit to you.
Yes, thanks for that. Now, the attacks continued for a few days, but the weather worsened and it soon became obvious.
Hang on, what month are we in? Remind me.
It's November now, isn't it?
Is it a surprise the weather's worsening?
No. And it soon became obvious that nothing more of any real value would be achieved. And so on the 18th of November, Haig suspended the attacks. At long last, the agony that was the Battle of the Somme was over. Well, certainly for the British.
Yeah, and the French, I mean, even for the British, the sort of dying echoes. This idea the Somme finishes on a certain day. We've had exposing other podcasts
what you're referring to is the fact that a gigantic conflict of that nature can't just be cut off abruptly. Don't say, right, 18th November, stop. The metaphorical corpse of the Somme battles carried on twitching for several more weeks. That's fantastic.
I'm just looking at you and imagining you twitching.
Hard fighting
several
continued
weeks
on the ground and in the air, only gradually dying down as winter took its icy grip. There would be one more distinguished victim of the Somme fight in that winter.
Who was that?
Well, at 1 o'clock on the 23rd of November, Major Lano Hawker, VC, who had led his squadron from the front throughout the long battle, took off for yet another patrol.
He's the first British ace. He's not only a VC, Victoria Cross, he was awarded the Victoria Cross, but he was also a bloody fine example as a man and as a leader to his squadron. And you've got a quote from Captain Alan Wilkinson, 24th Squadron.
From the earliest days, he was an inspiring leader and its devoted parent and friend. He means parent to the squadron. Before we left Hounslow, he had moulded the raw material on the right lines, and it was in the beginnings that the seeds of its future greatness were sown. those early runs in the morning which he himself led, those parades which we at the time thought rather unnecessary, those modest, almost confidential lectures, and equally those rags when all of us, himself included, dashed off to town for an evening's amusement, all went to form that character which was peculiar to 24 Squadron from its earliest days. When we met with our first reverses, three of our best had gone west. His was the grit and determination that controlled us all. His personal example as a fighter was first and foremost the cause of his squadron's success. As a friend and man, he was delightful, wonderfully childish in many ways, but at the same time always its correct, calm commanding officer, with ample reserve when required. Although the commanding officer, nothing amused him more than an orange thrown at someone's head, or a soda water siphon fight, and in what we jokingly called the Battle of Bert Angles between ourselves and 22 Squadron, he used more siphons than anyone.
What a character. He sounds lovely. On that fateful day, which I've already forgotten what the date was, 23rd of November, Captain John Andrews leads an A flight patrol of four DH2s. Now they're going across the German lines on an offensive patrol, and they were meant to be covering a photographic reconnaissance that's going on in this final, what you referred to as the death throes of the offensive. Who's with him? You've looked these names up as well, haven't you?
I have. So with him were Lieutenant Robert Saunby, Lieutenant John Crutch, and Major Lano Hawker himself, who once again was making up the numbers to ease the situation for his hard-pressed pilots.
Yeah, you remember that they'd issued an order that that commanding officers weren't to fly, but he'd always done it, and he did it whenever they were desperate or if a pilot was what they call sweating on leave. So if you were going to go home on leave, imagine you going to go home on leave, and you'd think, I might get killed before I get a chance to go and see the missus or the girlfriend or the dog or whatever you know.
Or all three.
And and he used to fly for them so that they weren't shot down the day before they went home, you know, when things might have been on their mind. He was a great man.
Now, anyway, on this particular control, as they took off, Crutch was forced to turn back as his engine failed him.
There's nothing worse than your crutch letting you down.
But the remaining three carried on regardless. It had been arranged that two other pilots, Lieutenants Long and Pashley, would reinforce the patrol at 2 o'clock. Now, after gaining altitude to around 11,000 feet, the patrol crossed the lines heading towards Bapaume. Here, at about 13:50, 10 to 2, they sighted two German aircraft flying below them at about 6,000 feet. And you're going to tell us what Captain John Andrews, who was there, says.
I attacked two hostile aircraft, HA, just northeast of Bapaume and drove them east when I observed two strong patrols of HA scouts above me. I was about to abandon the pursuit when a DH2 scout, Major Hawker, dived past me and continued to pursue.
Now, we're never going to know why Hawker continued to pursue the decoys. He may not have seen the lurking German hunting pack above him, or perhaps he was just carrying out his own dictum, which was...
Attack! Everything.
Exactly. And this is what Captain John Andrews of 24 Squadron goes on to say.
We were at once attacked by the HA, one of which dived onto Major Hawker's tail. I drove him off, firing about 25 rounds at close range. My engine was immediately shot through from behind, and I was obliged to try and regain our lines. When on the lines, another DH2 came diving past me from our side and drove the HA off my tail. I last saw Major Hawker at about 3,000 feet near Bapaume, fighting with an HA apparently quite under control, but going down. Now, who rescued Andrews?
Well, he'd been rescued by Lieutenant Saunby, and I'm going to tell you what Lieutenant Robert Saunby of 24 Squadron said. We were dived on by a patrol of 7 or 8 wharfishes. That's the Roland C2, which was known as the Whale. Sorry, that was me saying that, not him. One followed by another dived on me. I spiralled 2 or 3 times and the HA zoomed off. Then I saw a patrol leader being attacked by a wharfish and went to his assistance, diving onto the HA's tail. I emptied 3/4 double drum into him at about 20 yards range. He suddenly wobbled and dived so steeply with engine on that I could not follow him, although I dived up to 130 mile per hour. I flattened out and looked around but could see no other DH2s, and the HA appeared to have moved away east, where they remained for the rest of the patrol. I turned to see if the patrol leader was all right and saw him go down and land at the French landing ground behind Guillemont. I continued the patrol defensively alone until two other DH2s joined me at 2:30 p.m.
So patrol leaders, remember, Andrews, not Leonard Hawker. Yeah. Now, both of them, both Andrews and Saunby, they've lost contact with Major Hawker. And we don't really know how this all happened, but he's come face to face with somebody else, somebody that you rather admire. Who was it?
Well, he comes face to face with Lieutenant Manfred von Richthofen, Bolker's heir apparent. It was to be a desperate duel to the death.
Yeah, it was. It was. But it's not a fair fight. I want to make that clear, and we want to make this clear. Richthofen was a great scout ace, but Lanner Hawker was in a DH2, and against the Albatross D2 that Richthofen was in, all he could do better was turn. He could outturn him. It could turn in tighter circles, mainly because the Albatross was so powerful. That's all it's got. And what's it armed with as compared to two belt machine guns firing through or in between the propeller blades? What's he got? What's Lanner Hawker got?
He's got a single Lewis gun.
Yeah. Well, that's not a lot, is it?
It's not. And this is Lieutenant Manfred von Richthofen of Jaster 2.
Here we go.
So we circled round and round like madmen after one another at an altitude of about 10,000 feet. Soon I discovered that I was not meeting a beginner. He had not the slightest intention to break off the fight. He was travelling in a box which turned beautifully. However, my packing case was better at climbing than his. But I succeeded at last in getting above and beyond my English waltzing partner. When we had got down to about 6,000 feet without having achieved anything in particular, my opponent ought to have discovered that it was time for him to take his leave. The wind was favourable to me, for it drove us more and more towards the German position. At last, we were above by Palm, about half a mile behind the German front. The gallant fellow was full of pluck, and when we had got down to about 3,000 feet, he merrily waved to me, as he would say, "Well, how do you do?"
Could have been a two-fingered wave.
I had time to take a good look at my opponent. I looked down into his carriage and could see every movement of his head. If he had not had his cap on, I would have noticed what kind of a face he was making. My Englishman was a good sportsman, but by and by the thing became a little too hot for him. I followed him at an altitude of from 250 feet to 150 feet, firing all the time. The Englishman could not help falling, but the jamming of my gun nearly robbed me of my success. My opponent fell, shot through the head, 150 feet behind our line.
Now, that account is basically from the Red Air Fighter, and the translation's slightly dodgy, I feel. And also remember that this was
As was the accent.
Written in conjunction, I presume, with a journalist or ghostwriter. But it's a decent account. The thing that's most obvious is that all Hawker can do is turn. Richthofen's talking, I mean, he couldn't fly. He couldn't just land and give up. Obviously, he was a VC. He's attack everything. He wasn't that kind of man. I like to think, remembering how Richthofen died, that actually he wasn't shot down by Richthofen, but the Australians were in the front line and was shot down by an Australian in the front line. Going,
Yeah, and like you, I like to think that, you know, the pulling of the faces and the waving was actually, you know, two fingers to him.
Yeah, no, can you enjoy military history by thinking of what people would really be thinking? Well, I don't know.
Hawker was dead and he was just a few yards and seconds from safety.
Yeah, and he is an entirely admirable, so was Richthofen, an entirely admirable character and more lovable than Richthofen, I think it's fair to say, in the sense that Richthofen was quite hard.
Well, you could suggest that the circle was complete. The death of Immelmann in June 1916, just prior to the start of the Great Battle, had signified the rise to ascendancy of the Royal Flying Corps and the supremacy of the DH2s over the Fokker E-11. Now, Immelmann had been avenged, as the death of Hawker marks the swing back of the pendulum and the eclipse of the DH2 by the Albatross.
Yeah, and to add a touch of piquancy. The instrument of revenge, Richthofen, was a pupil of Immelmann's hunting partner. Max Immelmann's hunting partner was, of course, Oswald Bolker.
Yeah, Richthofen, he'd go on to lead the slaughter of the outclassed Royal Flying Corps machines throughout the next 6 months before the next generation of Allied aircraft made their belated appearance in May 1917.
Now, for the RFC, the Battle of the Somme, it's it's been going on a journey. And in that journey, if you like, it's come of age. It has come of age as a fighting service. Why?
Well, because its reconnaissance and observation role had been clearly defined earlier in the war. But the Somme was its first real air campaign fought in the teeth of a skillful, well-equipped and determined opposition. Now, General Gough summed up the general appreciation of the role played by the Royal Flying Corps. And you're going to tell us what he said.
During all the 3 months of fighting, the air service had been increasingly active and efficient. Fighting was not confined to the operations on the ground and to the muddy trenches. Much went on in the air. Oh, Churchill. Gradually and surely, our air service established a morale and material superiority over the enemy, although at the cost of many gallant young lives. But the work done was invaluable, especially in the direction of blanketing the enemy's observation of his artillery fire, while they assisted, guided, and directed ours most helpfully. No one of the complicated miscellany of services which comprises a modern army so commanded the respect and admiration of the infantry as did our air service. A miscellany of accents to go with.
Yeah.
Why am I so shit at accents?
Now, Haig, Rawlinson, Gough and their respective staffs greatly valued the regular detailed photographic reconnaissance of the trench systems facing their forces.
Yet they also recognise and appreciate the crucial role in artillery observation and just generally. And also, of course, they appreciate the harassing raids. The what raids?
Harassing.
Interdiction raids.
Harassing.
Interdiction raids. We're not going to... Anyway, that was my favourite joke of this whole series.
Have you swallowed an interdictionary?
Managed to repeat it. Yeah. So carry on.
They appreciated the harassing raids on the German rear sectors. They looked for bombing raids on strategically significant railway junctions to disrupt the German movement of reserve divisions. And of course, they insisted that the Royal Flying Corps scouts should deny similar facilities to the Germans.
So that's the role of the scouts. So, yeah. Now, the RFC, they could and did look back on the whole Somme campaign with considerable pride, and rightly so. And this is what Lieutenant Robert Archer of 42 Squadron RFC said.
I've often heard officers of other arms state that at times the supremacy of the air passed to the enemy. I challenge this statement. The side possesses the supremacy of the air, which is able to keep army cooperation machines in the front and to prevent the enemy from doing so. The question of which side has most casualties in doing so is immaterial to this question.
Now, the thing is that the casualties are not that large in comparison to the poor old infantry. Obviously they're not. But of the 583 RFC casualties suffered on the Western Front between June and December 1916, most were over the Somme battlefield. So of course they were. But it just fades into insignificance compared to the losses suffered by the infantry. But there is something where it is big or large or important. And what is that?
Well, as a proportion of those involved, if you take it as a percentage, it bore a grim comparison. In the tragic ledger of the Somme, the losses they suffered were set against the enormous value of their work. For the Royal Flying Corps, at least, it was a bit of a success.
Gary deliberately evaded saying Somme success, which is the name of my book I wrote about 40 years ago on this, which is still available from Pen and Sword for next to nothing. Now, that finishes this series. What have we got to look forward to, Gary?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. Just sitting in a cupboard again for the next few weeks.
Well, I'm going to get you out of your cupboard. In about six... What we're going to do is we're going to repeat in our Tales from the Vaults or whatever you want to call it.
Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Crypt, that's it. Voices from the Vault. We're going to repeat the Hague series. We're going to do all the way through. So the early life in the Sudan. Then we're going on the Boer War. We're going on to how he was involved in building up the army before the First World War. And then 14, 15, 16 and 17. Now you might think, hang on, whenever they go. Well, that is the repeat. Then we're going to do 1918.
A new one.
That starts the next series, and that'll be followed by Haig's life after the war. Après la guerre, indeed. And then what we're going to go on to do then? We're going to have a whole new series.
Yeah, a whole new series, which will be on the Third Eeps.
Looking forward to it, looking forward. And that'll be about seven.
Which is otherwise known as Passchendaele, mate.
Okay, Gary, well, it's time for us to go.
It's time for a well-earned rest.
Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit
blah.
www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blah, blah, blah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?